This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, a podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato and Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. Josh Bangs is a registered nurse and works in the community caring for the dying, a vocation he describes as a sacred privilege. In this wide-ranging conversation, he talks about his vocation, life, death, and what it means to be a good person.
So I'm Josh. I'm a registered nurse in the community for Hospice Waikato, and I've been nursing for 13 years and in healthcare for about 20 years.
Just before I turned the mic on, Josh, you said that when you're visiting at somebody's house, somebody who's dying, you feel it's a sacred thing that you're doing.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, people, it's a real privilege to be a nurse and to be invited into people's most vulnerable time. And people trust me with their journeys. They trust me to with very deep things that they wouldn't tell anybody else. I think often people become quite real when they're dying, and families, and it's such a privilege to be a nurse and to be trusted with people's stories, with people's lives, with things that people won't tell you, won't tell anybody else, or let anybody else see. And yeah, and that's what I'm kind of mindful of when I talk about the stories about the people that I care for. I'm mindful that I'm respectful of that. Because it's sacred. Yeah, really, it's a sacred thing, being allowed into someone's house in the most vulnerable time. So,
yeah. One thing I've found talking to people who are dying, and I think this is what you said, but I'm going to say it in a slightly different way. There's no artifice. There's none of the things that we pretend often as human beings. That all seems to fall by the wayside, and people show you their absolute true self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's
and it is a privilege to be that person who's experiencing that. It's a real special privilege.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's really taught me as well that it's taught me more to not judge books by the covers, because I think that meeting a diverse range of people has shown me that everybody really has fundamental human needs, regardless of culture and what, you know, where they come from. That sort of, you know, that need to have people that they love around them, and that need to feel like things mattered, that they made a difference, or that they've had value, and yeah. Fundamental physical things as well. People don't want to be in pain or have nausea or breathlessness and symptoms that can be associated with different life-limiting illnesses. So, it's really taught me to, when I see someone who I might have originally been a bit nervous to talk to, actually, it's helped me, yeah, to realise actually, you know, people are just people, really, until, yeah.
One of the things I've learnt from this and my other work collecting oral histories is my job is to listen and to be an active listener. There's no judgment, because sometimes people are telling you things that they're not sure about themselves, and they're looking at you, are you going to approve or disapprove? And I'm not there to judge, I'm there to listen. And I'm getting the sense that it's the same for you as a palliative care nurse.
Yeah. Yeah. I think when I first became a nurse, I think it's changed a lot in the last 13 or 14 years. You know, I think when I first became a nurse, it was all about fixing things and making everything better and being the nurse who's who knows everything and I'm ready to make things better. But I think, especially working for hospice, I've developed into sort of a bit more of a Sherpa, I call myself sometimes.
Sherpa, why a Sherpa?
Because I'm there to guide, I'm not there to tell. I can lay out a couple of paths before someone and say, what's best for you? How would you like to proceed? This might be a bit more of a rocky one. This one might be a bit steeper, but we'll get there a bit quicker. As opposed to going in and saying, right, this is what you need to do. And I think that kind of helps people to relax a bit, not thinking, oh, here's another person coming to tell me what to do. But actually, yeah, guiding and sherpering, for lack of a better word. And I think that, people, have all had different experiences with the health system, and being able to have control over the end part of their lives, I think, is really important. Yeah, so it's kind of, it's been a bit of a journey in my career to be able to get to that point where actually, it's not about my ego. It's about the person, and I might try a certain route, and the person blocks that, and I'm like, okay, we're going to do a detour and find a way that works with you. So yeah, it's quite. I think it's a helpful way to go about it, because then you're bringing the person along. It becomes their journey, and you're supporting it. Yeah.
How many people are you caring for at any one time, Josh?
It can be up to 20. It goes up and down because I look after Hamilton East, Ruakura, Rivoli, and Claudelands. So my numbers fluctuate up and down. Usually sitting around about 15, but we also support each other's patients. So that, if they're off for the day, then you might go and see someone else's patient and you read their notes and go and support that person. But, yeah, we have primary nurses. So a primary nurse looks after their own cohort of patients in certain areas. So they make sure that they've got a bit of oversight there as well. Yeah.
So you're primary nurse for?
For those areas.
Hamilton, yeah. East and?
Rakura and those places, yeah.
So, say if you've got 15 patients, do you see the patient every single day? Or
no.
How many times a week would you see one particular patient?
It depends on need. Some people we might meet early in their journey, and they might just need once a month visit just to check in, how are you getting on, and have you got any questions? Some people need visits every day because they need medicine to keep them comfortable every single day.
Pain relief.
Pain relief, symptom relief, so nausea, anxiety, agitation, secretions, things like that. So we might have a syringe driver or subcutaneous medications under the skin that we need to go in and check on and supporting the family through that time as well.
So I guess you're saying that when a person is first diagnosed with a terminal illness, the real intense support kicks in when they're reaching the end of the journey, when they're reaching the end of their lives?
Depends, because sometimes people can become really unstable and we get things in place and then they're okay for quite a long time. So say if someone's got COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, and they're going through a time of breathlessness where they're not quite sure which of their meds to take, and we need to go in there quite regularly to say, okay, well, so we can try some medicine and some meditation and using a handheld fan, for example. And then the person starts to learn and the family starts to learn, okay, this is how we manage breathlessness. We're okay now. We've sort of sorted it out. So we'd pull back a little bit and say, okay, well, that's good to hear. I'll see you in about 2 weeks. You call me if you need me. So, yeah, so some people can become unstable and then stabilize. Some people don't need us for the entire journey as well. Some people just need to be admitted under us. We put in things that are going to help, like acute supports and connecting with a counsellor and things like that, community supports, and teach them how to manage their symptoms. And sometimes people stabilise and can discharge, which is quite a surprise to some people. It was quite a surprise to me, actually, when I first started this job, that I didn't realise people could discharge from hospice, but yeah, people can as well. So that sometimes that's a bit of a reassurance for them when they first are, when you first see them.
So people, yes, I've only just sort of figured this out myself. As the last week, I think it's episode 8, talking with a chap called Mel Brooks, who's dying of prostate cancer. I sat with him in his room at hospice, and we talked, and he's going home today. He was in here for pain management. So he's probably got a few weeks, and he'll move into a home from the house he lives in. He'll move into a home. But yes, this is his second visit to hospice. So people come in to get their symptoms under control and their pain sorted out, and then they can move back again to their homes or wherever they are.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that. I thought once you came to hospice, you came here to die.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of people also think that hospice is just the 9-bedded, you know, amazing 9-bedded hospital we've got, but actually it's the 600 or so patients we've got in the community, where we do a lot of the work too. A lot of people, yeah.
So you've been a nurse for 14 years. How many years have you been in palliative care?
So in this role, I've been here in April, would have been here 3 years. But I've been a palliative champion in a rest home before, and I've always really enjoyed.
What's a palliative champion?
So I kind of created the role myself because I was passionate about palliative care. Because generally, especially in rest homes, you've got sort of one chance to make it right if they're in the palliative stage of their life, in the end stage of their life anyway. And so I took the role up to create a bit of a resource around, okay, so this is how we support people holistically. So using Te Whare Tapa Whā, which is the four walls of whānau, physical, spiritual, and emotional. Bringing in whānau for a meeting, how to hold a meeting about what to expect so that people are less traumatized or less anxious about what they're seeing, because they know, okay, this is what happens at the end of life. It's what can happen at the end of life. We've been talked through it. We're okay, you know.
For a lot of people, you know, haven't had the experience of seeing somebody die. And of course, when people are dying themselves, they often haven't witnessed somebody else die. So for a lot of people, it's a mystery.
Yeah. And one of the things I hear the most often, maybe it's just the people I've been talking to, but one of the biggest fears or one of the biggest misconceptions is people saying, oh, this person had a horrible death because they had the death rattle. So they were breathing, you know, through secretions, or was making a lot of noise. They must have been in terrible discomfort. And being able to say to people, actually, when someone's unconscious, they're breathing through a thin layer of fluid, and they're comfortable, because if they weren't, they'd be trying to clear it. You know, that kind of gives a bit of solace and a bit of reassurance, a lot of reassurance to people. Oh, okay, actually, this is just like sucking the bottom of a fizzy drink. You know, that sort of rattly sound. And it's not a sign of discomfort. It's okay, you know. And yeah, I've heard quite frequently people not realizing that that's a sign of comfort, because there's no grimacing, there's no clutching of the bed sheets, there's no trying to clear it. It's just breathing for a little bit of fluid. And yeah, so preparing people for that.
How correct am I in thinking that most of us really don't know anything about the process of dying?
yeah, very much so. It's not something that gets talked about unless it happens.
Is it healthy to talk about it?
I think so. I think it's going to happen. It's going to happen regardless of whether we talk about it or not. I think we had to be really sensitive with how we talk about it with people. Because everybody's, you know, brings in their own journey, their own baggage, for lack of a better word. So some people might be more ready to talk about it than others. But I think normalising death is an important thing as well. Because I think that, you know, seeing someone swoon and then swoon and die on a movie is a really not particularly accurate description of how people die. So,
how do people die generally?
So generally we see, so everybody has their own journey, of course, but we generally see little signposts along the way. So we might see someone starting to eat a bit less, starting to want to sleep a bit more, maybe not wanting people around as much, some people. They might just want to sort of cocoon and sleep very deeply. And generally, if we're able to manage the symptoms well and turn the volume down on symptoms, and depending on the disease process, generally people tend to sleep deeper and deeper and deeper and longer and longer. And eventually their breathing will change. There might be long gaps in between breathing. There might be some secretions, the death rattle that I talked about. And then the breaths become further and further apart until the person stops breathing. And that's probably, it's hard to generalise because everybody has their own dying journey, but that's generally the milestones that we see, or the signposts.
One of the things I've learnt talking with palliative care professionals is that, yeah, with a bit of experience, people can tell, they can say, well, I think he'll probably, or she'll probably die in the next 2 or 3 hours, or maybe you've got a day left.
Yeah.
And it's usually pretty spot on.
Yeah. And of course, there's always outliers as well, you know, and I always say, in my experience, what I'm seeing, we may have hours to short days or short days to short weeks. But I always say everybody has their own journey. They're going to do what they're going to do. Because I've you know, been in healthcare for 20 years, I've seen both ends of the spectrum where someone somehow has been 20 days without food or water. And I've seen the other side where someone just slips very quickly and dies quite quickly. So I always give that bit of a caveat around that.
So you've obviously seen a lot of people die.
Mm.
When you first started in this kind of work, what was your experience of death?
Okay, so 20 years ago, I remember my first death that I ever saw, and I was 17, I'm 37 now. And I'd never seen anybody, obviously it was my first death. And I was working in a rest home as a caregiver, 17, and I was there with my senior caregiver who said looked at the person and went, "Oh no," and then ran out of the room to get the nurse. And I was in there in the room with this man staring blankly, and I was kind of waving my hand, being 17 and an experience of waving my hand in front of his face, thinking, "Oh, what's going on here?" And they came back, "Oh, he's died." "Oh." And I was thinking, how do I feel about that? You know, it was a surreal time. Yeah, and we went through, back then we went through the process of clean, helping, giving him his last wash and laying him out and getting a flower, popping it on the bed, on the pillow, and getting him ready for his family to come in.
So you washed him?
Mm.
What was it like to be 17 and to be touching a dead body?
Once I gotten over the shock that this person wasn't blinking, because I kind of thought he might have died, but I...
So his eyes were wide open?
Yeah, just staring blankly. And once I got over that part of it, I think it became quite a tradition. It was nice. It was really beautiful to be a part of that tradition. I think being 17, just thinking back, I think it made me really aware of my own mortality more than I think a lot of 17-year-olds are generally. But also, once I'd gone through my first laying someone out, cleaning, getting them ready for the family, it became kind of a tradition and quite an honour to be able to do that for people. So, okay, you know, wear the flowers in the garden, in the rest home garden, and clip one, put it on the pillow, get them ready, comfort the family. Yeah, but it also made me very, at the time, yeah, aware of my own mortality, which was quite scary, I think, as well. I think just realizing that this life is going to end, you know. And it's still a bit, it's still actually, yeah, it's probably being young, it's still unfathomable to imagine that I will no longer exist someday. You know, it's still, even though I've worked for 20 years with so many people, it's still my own death. it sounds strange, but my own death is really hard to comprehend. Not necessarily the dying part, because I kind of, unless it's very sudden, I know the mechanics of that. But the not existing part still kind of, yeah. I'm not ready to, I wouldn't be comfortable with that at the moment, anyway.
You want to be alive?
Yeah. I want to be alive, and got a few things I want to accomplish first, you know, before I feel comfortable saying, oh yeah, I've left a good things behind, and yeah, dad of young kids, and I just sort of, yeah, but I think this role has made me think of what I'd want to do if I was to be been told I had a terminal illness now. And I've thought about the Council of Dads. I've heard about relatively young dads having Council of Dads. So they get around a few good men that they think, oh yeah, if you've got the values, I'd like to carry on to raise my kids. And they become the people who take them to the first school ball, and give them advice and, you know, check out the new boyfriends and all those sort of milestones, you know, that come up. Yeah, and it kind of, yeah, I think that's is one of the things I'd want to do, as well as doing video mementos for different milestones. And yeah, I think this role makes you aware of your own mortality. I think working with families who aren't necessarily dying, working in other roles in residential care, has taught me to go on the trips when you can. Because I've seen too many families who have saved and saved and saved and saved. As soon as we turn 65 or 60, we're going to go and do our world trip. And then one gets dementia or has a stroke and suddenly everything's changed. And it's kind of, I think it's really, working for hospice and working as a nurse has really given me that awareness that life is so precious and you don't know what's around the corner. So saving so that you've got a future, but also doing things when you can.
Living in the moment a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. You can't completely live in the moment because you've got to try and, you've got to get things ready for if you do have a long life, but also, you know, going on that cruise or going on a hike or starting that hobby you've always wanted to get into and things like that. It's kind of made, yeah, I think when you know what can happen, it gives you that bit more of a motivation to.
So what you're saying is, you're not afraid of death, you just don't want to die just yet.
Yeah, and I don't want to no longer exist. I suppose that's around that's why I think about what legacy would I like to leave. You know, wanting my kids to be okay with the Council of Dads, and yeah, and I want to, I suppose my spirituality is thinking that I've made the world a better place, or a slightly better place, or made a difference, or there's been meaning to my existence here on Earth. Yeah, and I suppose it just comes down to wanting, having a lot more to get done, you know. Does that make sense?
So, tell me again about the Council of Dads. Is this an actual thing?
Mm.
Is this an organisation? Like, if I Googled it, or is it something that you organise?
Yeah, I've seen people, like, you know, videos of people who are terminal, and they've got young girls or young boys, or both, and they've said, right, you know, I'm not going to be around to do all these parental things, you know, passing on my wisdom and, you know, to rolled eyes and to when they're ready to accept our wisdom. But yeah, it's when you get these people together. It's a bit of an informal thing, but
you find people that you think would be suitable.
Yeah,
and you ask them to be involved in the lives of your family.
Yeah, yeah.
I've not heard of that before.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And then I think a lot of people's big worry is, are my kids going to be okay? And, you know, is my wife going to be okay, or husband? Or I think that being able to know that things are planned and things are, you know, you've done the best you can to make things okay, gives you a lot more peaceful death, I think.
So you just mentioned your spirituality, that your spirituality is to leave the world a better place than what you found it.
Mm.
Are you religious?
No, not particularly.
Do you believe in an afterlife? Do you believe in a God?
I don't know. I think I'm a lot more ritualistic than when I first started, before I started hospice. Like,
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but that is interesting, because you described your first death as the beginning of a kind of love affair with ritual, cleansing of the body, true. And being part of that. So you're obviously a person who's naturally drawn to that kind of thing, and you feel very comfortable in that role.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, that's true, actually. But now, if once a patient has died, I will go home and light a candle and just think about them and thank them for allowing me to be part of the journey. And it's kind of my way of closure, I guess, because you get to meet these wonderful people and get to really know them and get to be part of a very vulnerable, precious time of their life. And I think that has to have meaning, as opposed to just, you know, doing the paperwork. I think that's a way of, and of course I ring the family and check in and say what I loved about, or liked, you know, really enjoyed about their person. But yeah, that's just my way of recognising special people, I think, is lighting a candle, thinking about them for a little bit, letting the candle burn for a while. Yeah.
And you don't, so you're not sure about God?
Mm.
Afterlife?
It's another one of, I don't know. If I get thinking about existence too much, it kind of rocks my brain, blows my mind a little bit, because there has to be a beginning, but what began that beginning? And it's unfathomable to be able to try and imagine. I wonder if just my opinion, I wonder if the answer is too great or too complex for us to even understand. Just my approach. I don't know. I was raised religiously, but I've developed a sort of a belief that unless I have really strong evidence for things, I won't accept it as a belief. But also that I see the utility of religion in people's lives. So of that being able to have that comfort of believing that they're going somewhere, or they're going to see relatives, or that this is not the end. But also, you can still find beauty even without religion. I've left the world a better place. I've created beautiful kids with good values. I've made a bit of a difference.
See, some religious people would argue that you can't have good values and you can't do good things in the world unless you have faith in God and have these religious values.
Yeah, and I suppose it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's so many different religions in the world too. And which religious values? Is it the existence of a God, or is it... It's a tricky one, because I suppose, like, you hear about people saying, well, what stops you from doing horrible things? Well, I do as many horrible things as I want to, which is none. What stops you from going out and murdering people and having no morals? Well, it's like one of my friends said, I do as many murders as I want to, which is zero. I think being a human and being empathetic and really caring for people, I don't think that comes from religion. I think that comes from being a human.
Good conscience is not the exclusive domain of religious people.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think you can find all sorts of different types of people and many different types of groups, and good and bad in every group, I think. And I suppose for me, not knowing what lies beyond, and knowing, for my meaning of life, it gives me, it makes me think that this is all I've got, as far as I'm aware. So I better make the best I can of it. I better, apologize for things that I've made mistakes, and I should care and nurture those people that I love. I should try and make it a better place as much as possible, as much as I can within my ability, because this might be all I have. I don't know. And it's a tricky one, because I mean, I'm not, if I received good evidence for there being something that lies beyond, or there being a great creator, then absolutely I'd be on board. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's enough beauty in caring for people. There's enough beauty in climbing a mountain and looking at a beautiful view and thinking, oh, this is beautiful. And I don't think it makes a difference for me whether it's been created by a god or created by evolution, or, evolution over time, or rocks being smashed into with volcanic ash and it's created this beautiful scenery. It's just beautiful. There's just beauty all around us, and I think that's enough for me until I find out that, find enough evidence that there is a creator, or, and then it comes down to which one. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's at odds. To finish my ramble, it's at odds with not being religious. I don't think it's at odds with what I do anyway.
But interesting what you said about, caring for people, what constitutes a good life, caring for people, being decent, apologising for your mistakes, And that's a conversation that's sort of taking place in society at the moment.
Mm.
What constitutes a man? You know, we've got this phenomenon of male influencers who think that men have to be dominant and they have to be macho and they have to be angry and they have to, the woman has to do what they're, you know, I'm the boss.
Yeah.
You live in my house. You do as I say. That's a lot of people are worrying about that male standard. But what do you think constitutes a good man?
I think a good man is a man that is comfortable being who they are. They're not trying to be someone they're not. So they're not trying to be more macho if they don't, you know, if they don't need to be. I think a good man is someone who, if they've got children, they raise them and support the other parent. I think the answer to what makes a good man is shifting every generation, isn't it? Because back in the 90s or 80s when I was growing up, there was a very clear differentiation between roles, I think, and probably would have been even more so before the 80s. But now I think it's becoming a little bit more fluid. Like there's no, well, in my household, there's no, that's men's work, that's women's work. It's kind of how can we work together to support each other to get through this time with young kids. So who's making dinner tonight? Okay, I've got something. Like before I came to here today, I created, got some meat marinating in the fridge and got things ready for the evening so it's easier. I think there's, when I was growing up, the macho or the masculine thing was to be hard and, for lack of a better phrase, you know, I've got this great big defense up and
no emotional. We don't show our emotions.
Yeah. It's just, you know, namby-pamby stuff. But actually, I think it's actually more masculine or more strong to be able to say, actually, this is who I am. I love people. I am going to show my emotions. I'm going to be real. To be real, I think being authentic, there you go. I think what makes a good man is being authentic. Authenticity, not I've got to be rigid and you know, clench my muscles all the time and sort of walk around like with a stick up my spine, you know. I think being true to yourself and being true to who you are. And
what constitutes a good parent?
It's a tricky one. These are really good questions because I think I've always said, like, no matter what you do as a parent, there's always someone who's going to disagree with your choice of parenting. So, you know, if we're trying to be nurturing and supportive and trying, you know, not to growl too much, not to yell too much, then there's going to be someone saying that you're making them entitled. And then if you're a bit stressed and you're taking you're taking the kids shopping and next thing they're taking off down the aisles and you're getting grumpy and you're calling them to come back, then someone else will say you're being a bit too harsh. So I think a good parent is someone who tries, to put it, is someone who loves their kids. They do their best. They try. They're present. They put their phone down if they can, you know, and there's different, it's such a tricky question because there's different seasons in people's lives too. So it might be that something really stressful is happening and they might not be able to be the best parent that they can be at that time, but they give it what they can out of what they got. But when they can, I think putting the phone down in another room, being present with the kid, I think that's really important for parenting, in my opinion. Seeing them as little humans, little people, as opposed to, you know, who needs to do as I say. It's like, okay, how are we going to figure it out, you know, in a way that works, which is easy, you know, easier said than done when it's been a long day and you're very tired and they've been out running around all day, but somehow they've got another burst of energy at 6 in the evening. You're like, how on earth did you get that burst of energy? But yeah, I think doing our best and caring about the little people that we've got, I think that's the best we can do, really.
Your job, I guess it comes with emotional demands.
Yes.
Do those, you know, you experience things that most of us don't experience, and you experience those on a daily basis, and the rest of us might experience those two or three times in a lifetime.
Yeah.
Does that ever follow you home?
Yeah, it can do. I think that's part of the lighting the candle as well, is kind of, you know, it's been a really hard day and I just need some time to process. Or sometimes I'll come home and just say, not often, but sometimes something can really affect me deeply at work, and I'll just come home and say, I'm so sorry. I'm feeling sad today, you know.
Do your children know what you do?
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
Do they understand what you do?
I think that my 9-year-old has a bit more of an understanding than my 6-year-old. And my 6-year-old went through that stage of realising that she's going to die one day and asking lots and lots of questions about death. So I just had to be very patient and answer them at a level that she could understand. It was really tricky because she said, am I going to die one day? And a 6-year-old concrete thinking, it's quite tricky to say to, yes, but it's very, very unlikely it's going to be anytime soon, you know. Are you going to die someday? Yeah, I am, but not for a very long time, you know. There's no reason why I'm going to die, you know, very soon. And because I don't want to lie to them, but also you don't want them to be freaked out that dad's going to drop dead at some point. So it's kind of like, okay, how can I say this in a level that you can understand? And yeah, she went through lots and lots of questions once I started my role.
Some people I've talked to say it's important that children don't know about death. Let children be children. Let them live in this lovely, naive space where the horrors of the world or the difficult things about life don't exist.
Mm.
Where others say it's important to inform kids, and just from an early age to let them know that people die. There are good people and there are bad people.
Mm.
What do you think?
So I had a family that had young kids, grandchildren, and there was quite a bit of turmoil. So a family I was caring for. There's some turmoil, there's some worry around how the kids were going to react to the death. And I brought my very clever counsellor colleague along with me. And she very wisely said, the children will take the cues from the adults in the house. So if the adults are saying, you know, if they're fighting about the person who's dying, or they are particularly anxious, then the children might be particularly anxious or having, you know, being very uncomfortable. So I think children have been around adults who are able to normalise it. And yeah, and is really important. I think it's important. But then, like, going back to my Sherpa thing, I'm not there to tell them. I'm there to say, well, I've noticed that this helps in certain situations. Well, what works for you with the families? Because there's many different cultures, many different beliefs. I think children are going to... They know when things aren't right. They know when adults are not okay, because they're constantly watching our faces, right? You know, to see our emotional, what's going on for us. And I think that they're going to make something up if they don't know what's happening anyway. So, because kids aren't stupid. They know that something's not right. So being able to say to them, you know, this is what's happening. Popper's not very well, and we're doing everything we can to make him comfortable, but he won't be able to throw the ball around anymore. You might want to come and give him a cuddle if you want to. And yeah, so normalising things, I think, is really important. That's my opinion, anyway. Yeah.
I've just been talking to Sophie, that's the episode before this one, about her experience with assisted dying.
Mm.
And that's a subject I'm very keen to keep on broaching through series two of The Last Breath, because we now have legal assisted dying in New Zealand, but mm-hmm. we also have a lot of people are not very informed about it and what it means. And one of the things that I've learnt so far is that people are very cautious about, if they've made that decision, they're very cautious about who they tell, because a lot of people are quite dead set against it.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people have made that choice, they don't want to argue and debate. They don't want to be put through this emotional circus.
Mm.
So sadly, it's something that's still a little bit, has a bit of a veil thrown over it still. Could you give me your perspectives, your personal perspectives on assisted dying?
I think it's useful to have as an option. And interestingly, I can't remember what the stats are, but there's a huge proportion of people who become eligible for assisted dying who don't use it. So I think having it, a lot of people seem to use it as a back pocket, almost like a parachute, if they feel like their dying journey isn't going as well as they thought it would. It doesn't change the way that I support people. I think that, I don't know, because of my perspective about things, I think people are going to do things regardless of whether it's legal or not, if it's really important to them. And I think back in the day, people dying without anybody in the room is really sad, because people, you know, if they were in the room with the person who was ending their life, then they could be criminally prosecuted. And so people would die alone because of a choice that they've made, which is, you know, I think people, you wouldn't know what it's like to make that decision until you're in that person's shoes, you know? I think it's a good thing with the current restraints, with the current criteria and, yeah, needing to make sure there's no coercion. Doctors needing to make sure there's no coercion. I think that's important as well, to have those safeguards, safety rails. So that, you know, because we meet people who say, oh, I don't want to be a burden on anybody anymore. So that's why it's good to make sure that there's no coercion. There's no one saying, well, you know, we can't afford to have your home or to support you, I think, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever regret the choices you've made to work in this profession?
No, not at all. There's such a privilege to walk into someone's home. It's chaotic. This is just an example of one of the things we do. Walk in someone's home, it's chaotic, they can't get their breath back, the family are stressed, and the person's so agitated, they've got terminal agitation, and I was able to set up some medications, get them in place, show the family how to do it, suggest that they put on some beautiful music, whether it be Led Zeppelin or Bach or whatever the person enjoys. Have someone massaging their feet if that's something that they enjoyed. Have them pray, have them sing, whatever the person is right for the person. And then everything's calm and you've made a difference and you've set things up so that they can continue to keep the person calm with the whole holistic approach. And it's, there's nothing better than that tangible feeling of making a difference to someone's journey. And also to the person's, to the family's grief as well. Because of course a journey where someone's not able to have had the symptoms controlled or come to terms with certain things can lead to complex, really difficult grief afterwards as well. So yeah, no, it's such a privilege to do what I do. And getting to know people really deeply, creating those relationships with people, it's just such an awesome... It's why I became a nurse, actually. You know, I was always... When I was 14, so 23 years ago, I think, I started volunteering at a rest home. And I would help feed residents and sing Danny Boy with them and learned all these lovely old songs, Daisy Daisy. And I think I found my passion for it then, even like when I was 14. So it's always been something that I've loved to do, is to support people and really make a tangible difference in people's lives. It's such a cool thing to be able to do. And I think working for hospice, it increases the amount of support that we're able to give. It allows us to think outside of, or me, to think outside of the box a little bit. As to how can we actually help this person have a comfortable journey, because it might not just be medications, it might be that the person has too many weeds in their garden and they're stressed because every day they've, you know, throughout their lives they've been out there making the garden beautiful and they're looking at this sad garden and it's just horrible for them to sit there and look at it. So we might get a volunteer to come out and weed someone's garden. Or someone might be really sad that they're not going to see the next Christmas, most likely. So we can get people in to support them with an early Christmas. Or I've been to a wedding, a backyard wedding, which is just beautiful. One of my patients and their wife or their loved one. It was just beautiful to see, and we supported with one of our volunteers came and their photographer, so they took photos and one of the community businesses lent some gazebos, and it was just so lovely to see and such a privilege to be part of. And that man died married to his loved one and peaceful and also knowing and being able to reassure them, hey, for the next big stretch of time after death, we have counselling available for... If your loved one gets to your first birthday or the first Christmas and realizes this is really hard, we're still there for them. And people dying knowing that their loved ones aren't going to be left behind or aren't going to be left in it is also helps for a bit more peaceful journeys, I think. So yeah, being able to facilitate that all is just such a privilege. Yeah.
There's been some discussion in the media lately about an ageing population, the cost of having a hospice system.
Mm.
Would society, how much worse off would we be if we didn't have hospice? What does hospice bring to New Zealand?
It's like I said before, I suppose my first thought would be, it's like I said before about the complex grief that can be caused by horrendous experiences of death and dying. Some people, you know, are unable to ever get past that, understandably. So I think the symptom relief and the support that we give for people to live the best days that they can, which is, you know, what we're here to do, is to support people to live the best days. I think that would lead to so much more grief and sadness in society. Yeah, because we without hospice, I think death would be a lot more medicalized, and we support people, a lot of people, to die in their own homes, surrounded by their pets and loved ones, and that cross stitch on the wall that they made when they were in their, you know, early 20s and still up there, because one of the proudest things of, you know, proudest parts of their lives, what they created, this beautiful thing, or little personal effects. I think there's a real strong need for people to die how they wish to die as much as possible. They wouldn't be able to, I don't think that would be able to happen without hospice nurses or without a hospice team. Because, well, I think part of it is that because this is our profession, we're able to take that time to, yeah, think outside the box and to think holistically and support the whole person, which is really essential. Because we talk about this thing called total pain, which is the pain is not just physical, it's also emotional, spiritual. And being able to understand that and to really dive deep into actually, is a person agitated because they haven't moved the bowels for a few days? Or is it that someone, they haven't been able to reconcile with someone? You know, is there something else going on that's causing distress or nausea or discomfort? You know, and I think that's the skill and the beauty of what we do. So yeah, that wouldn't be present if we weren't around.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.